In this episode, Janice Legata, Let Greg Live, Christian A. Smith. Welcome. A serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism. Welcome, friends. I am Ro Hattie. Recording on Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. A serial season called Farewell Evangelicalism. This is episode 8. Don't forget to rate and share the show. In this episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about what happens when you start processing all the weird. In other words, deconstruction. Deconstruction, however, from a black and brown church experience. Many evangelicals have decried, worked against, especially the pastors, this notion of deconstruction, which is just folks trying to find life when they know something weird is pressing against their whole selves in church traditions. And rather than interrogating what's wrong in evangelicalism or any church tradition, these pastors and leaders, they blame deconstruction and say people just want to sin. How convenient. And that's not just white pastors either. Any conservative pastor, we've heard them. We have the receipts talking about deconstruction in the pejorative. So it's important to cast a wide net when it comes to malformed theological ideas that are still in existence in pews and in pulpits. To be fair, we have to cast a wider net. Although this series is entitled Farewell Evangelicalism, we only pick on evangelicals because they have the most power and they are the largest voting bloc. However, new data from Faith Counts, where Research Director Ryan Burge, and go follow him on all the socials for the latest stats, he just produced data on the presidential vote choice among mainline denominations. Now, mainline, you think liberal, but liberal in politics and liberal in your theology are not the same things. We often conflate mainline and progressive churches, and those two don't mix. The data shows in the primary and largest mainline denominations in America, United Methodist, Evangelical Lutheran, American Baptist, Presbyterian, Episcopal, United Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, all but the Episcopal Church have seen incremental increases and the majority of their congregants voting for the Republican candidate in presidential elections over the past 5 election cycles. In other words, we can blame evangelicals, but the reality is all Christians in America, white Christians, overwhelmingly vote for Republican candidates. To me, this is unsurprising because if you've ever scratched below the surface of mainline denominations or churches, you will realize that there is a facade when you scratch to bedrock, a bedrock steeped in white supremacy. So although I won't apologize to evangelicals and enjoy punching up, virtually all white denominations in America play a role. In this episode, on deck, Janice Legata, who will chat about her time at Hillsong New York before its cataclysmic implosion. Let Greg Live is going to come and talk about his experience meandering through his black church experience, but also with the white church as well, as we speak to aspects of decolonization. All three will talk about decolonization and deconstruction. Christian A. Smith will finish off our conversation, and we're going to hit up on all aspects: deconstruction, white supremacy, decolonization. Don't want to miss. Let's just jump straight in. I'm Ro Hattie, recording on Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Don't forget, rate the show, share it with all your friends. Let's spread the word of how you can find life-giving faith. It's somewhere out there. Let's go find it.
I am Janice Legata. I am situated on the lands of Uhaviatam and Marengayam in California. Born and raised in church. I didn't recognize it as white evangelicalism at first, but it was the whole time. I basically grew up in the same church from, I think I was like 6 or 7 when we started going there. And I was at that church until I left to go to Hillsong College. So I grew up in Riverside, California, was part of a small Pentecostal charismatic church. So it was the kind that starts at 9:30. When it ends, only the Spirit knows that.
White church?
See, this is where things get tricky, right? Because I grew up under a Black woman pastor.
Uh-huh.
And, however, the theology, it was non-denominational, but came from the Assemblies of God. And, you know, Kenneth Copeland, Kenneth Hagin, there's just all these very white old men who were the spiritual fathers of, you know, my pastor. So, Black face, white theology, mixed congregation. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, like, on the surface, very progressive, right? But again, it's the theology. And I should have known. I mean, if I had been thinking that way, I would have recognized it sooner. If I would have recognized how easily I slipped into Hillsong culture once I got there. And so I moved to Australia in 2005 to go to Hillsong College, and was going to be there for a year, and then would go back to my little church and live and die in California. That was the plan.
Yeah.
But once I got to Hillsong, I mean, Hillsong was very good at what it did. Influential for a lot of people in a lot of ways. But like, again, I went there for the worship music. But then once I got into the church, they were doing church the best, right? They were the top of that game, too. And so you get into one cult and you can't still be in the other one. So I ended up staying in Australia for 4.5 years and then moved to New York. I didn't know at the time that Hillsong was coming to New York, but they ended up following me a few months later. And then I was
they
like,
sure oh. did.
So yeah, it launched in 2010. I was there, and then I was there until 2017.
What were the alluring factors that was like, this is distinct, and for this part of my life, I want it?
It was definitely the coolness factor. And just the polish. Theologically, Hillsong just put a different veneer on things. Like, I came from a very legalistic, and not in the sense of, you know, I mean, I had a woman pastor. So it wasn't like we had to wear skirts or like kind of hold some of the old conventions.
Yeah.
But the ideas of, you know, depravity and not being able to, you know, the heart is deceitful and wicked and who can know it. And so you can't trust yourself. You have to be under somebody's leadership. You have to be constantly in the Bible. You have to be, you know, warring against your flesh, wary of your flesh at all times, all the time. And so Hillsong was the same. Ultimately, right? But up front, they just present it in a very different fashion.
Yeah.
It was younger, for one, right? And it just made it was more about, all those things are true, but it's because, like, God loves you so much, and God has, you know, such a big plan for your life, and you are a wretched, horrible human being,
but
God can use you. And wouldn't you like to be used here?
Didn't Bieber go to that church?
He did,
at Hillsong.
I mean, I was given and giving the summary. Listen, a lot of people know me. And I ended up on these streets because I happened to start podcasting about a month before Carl Lentz went down. And a month before Hillsong NYC started self-destructing. And so anyone attached to Hillsong had a kind of automatic in. And then I was someone who was, again, I'd been there from day one. I had wanted to be on the worship team from the beginning. Didn't make the cut, but I became the lead of the stage managing team. Once they started doing services, that was my job. That was my volunteer position. That's what I was doing. And so through that, I was somebody that saw Carl Lentz and who was seen by Carl Lentz all the time. So we struck up this friendship. Yeah, we were buddies. And then, you know, through that association, I did eventually end up on the worship team. I ended up writing Hillsong New York would do weekly connect groups, so like a Bible study. So I was writing all the studies for that. So I was basically, you know, Hillsong New York's curriculum. That was me writing that. From that, I ended up writing, co-writing, ghostwriting sermons for one of the associate pastors. And through all that, you know, me and Carl are still buddies. And then when 2016 hit and Black Lives Matter and all of that was going on, then I was someone that he was talking to about those kind of issues and kind of using as a front and as a facade for progress. And
doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was me. And so a lot of the allure, my allure in the early days was like, ooh, this was someone who knew Carl Lentz. And Carl Lentz is a big deal because he knows Justin Bieber. And yeah, Justin Bieber is going to this church and all of that. So yeah, within my 6 degrees of separation, right, there's Justin Bieber.
When did the wheels start to come off?
Yeah. Whew. I mean, there were several wheels being peeled back.
Yeah, sure.
And I think maybe it was probably in 2015, maybe, when I took my first kind of break from Hillsong. Because, you know, the racial stuff was a thing. But, like, Hillsong had so many problems besides that, and had problems the whole time, right? And it's, you know, it's the little foxes that spoil the vine, right? So lots and lots of little foxes. So then in 2016, Carl wasn't there that week. I knew he wasn't going to be there. And then I knew, I was like, oh, I can't go because I don't know who's going to be up there, but I can't subject myself to whatever they're going to say about this killing, because I can't trust that anyone else on this staff. Carl's not doing, like,
he's not the answer either. Yeah.
Right. And he's not doing a great job, right? Especially not in hindsight. But he, at that time, was getting a lot of acclaim because he was the only, here's the white pastor saying Black Lives Matter.
He said something. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's getting all that kind of attention. Yeah. So he will. He is at least saying that much, right? But I'm like, I don't know what any of these other fools are going to say, so I can't go. And so that was like the first time that I kind of mentally clocked, like, I'm not safe here. Like, there's so many contingencies to me being safe. And so that started me thinking, like, man, like the church is weird. And the church is run like a business, but I have more protections at work than I do.
Yeah, dang. Yeah, a lot of people like that.
I'm having the same issues, feeling the same tensions at work, feel at church. And it feels like that shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's supposed to be like that.
Yeah, something ain't right here.
But we're having the conversations, right? And he's having meetings.
Take time. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to give it time and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so, all throughout 2016, there are all these tensions, and the tensions are growing within the church, but where then we're having these meetings, and then it's like, okay, do we give it more time? Do we not? And then there was a moment I can't remember if I was coming or going from service, but it was between services, and we were out front, and there were some kids playing, and like I knew these kids, and I, you know, kind of watched them grow up. So they're like, I don't know, like 6 and 8 at that time. Little boy and a little girl, biracial black kids. The little girl was wearing a hat, and so her brother knocked her hat off. And then I'm joking, and I'm like, oh, like, you know, you never mess with a black woman's hair. And the little girl, she goes, I'm not black, I'm brown. And I just had this moment of like, oh my gosh, like,
yeah,
this anti-blackness is already in there. And I'm not saying that Hillsong did this, but nothing in this place is.
Yeah. Would point that kid to liberation, their right. own liberation. Yeah.
Right. And so I was like, ooh, I would never want to raise a kid in this environment.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait, I'm somebody's kid. I'm like, if this is this is not someplace that would be safe for a child of mine.
Yeah.
This is not a place that's safe for me. I don't know how much longer I can be here. And then like I officially resigned, officially informed, you know, powers that be, that I wasn't ever coming back in July of 2017. But the last time I was like actually kind of in church faithfully was the last weekend of that February of Black History Month, because I gave Carl had me write and perform like a spoken word poem. So I did that. I think I'm done.
Yeah. Your body was looking out for you. Say, we got to go. You'll figure it out later. Did you say that you ghost wrote sermons?
Yes, I did.
Did they pay you for that?
They didn't pay me for any.
No, get out. No. People do that. And B, you didn't get paid. You didn't get named. Mm-hmm. And blah.
Like evangelicalism does so much to separate us from ourselves and from our wants. And it makes everything that we want evil, right? Like we distrust anything that we want. And so even in deconstructing, we can kind of be hard on ourselves because like, oh, well, I mean, I only deconstruct it because I cared about me. And so I think a lot of people feel like a lot of people in ex-evangelicalism now are not doing the decolonizing work that they need to be doing. And I think there's a level of shame around that because they don't want to admit that that's not why they deconstructed. Like they don't want to deal with that. Like there, we have like this list of best reasons to deconstruct. And we're like, oh, we'll accept that. We'll accept that. That's nice. But any reason for deconstructing is a good reason. And if you still believe in God, then I believe that God put that chink in your armor. That God made you aware of whatever the thing was that discouraged, discouraged you and that caused you to rethink things. And whatever that thing was, however now a few years down the road, superficial or silly it may seem to you, it wasn't superficial or it wasn't silly because it was enough to get you out. And so there is something in you that is enough to get you to whatever your next step is. Listening to yourself, even when it seems silly and or superficial, that's always going to be the main component. And then just doing the work of following that thought, following that
following
fear,
that voice.
Following, yeah, leaning into that thing, whatever it is, and exploring it. Because that's also how you learn. That's how you learn to hear from yourself. That's how you learn to trust yourself. That's how you learn to do your work, to do your research. You know, no one can give anyone else an exact roadmap because we're all coming from different directions. But all I know is that, okay, we all, something in us made us all look up at some point and be like, wait a minute. So the, again, thing,
yeah,
the next thing,
there's an alertness. Yeah.
Yeah. You have it. It's in you.
Janice and I pivot our conversation to chat about deconstruction and the contemporary versions of deconstruction, particularly how lapsed evangelicals or ex-evangelicals deal with the demands of deconstruction. It looks a little bit different if you're a white person.
I've been in the deconstruction game 5 years now, right? And I had a head start in decolonization because it directly affected me, right? But like, you know, white people's, I think a lot of times think when non-white people are talking to them about decolonizing and about white supremacy, they feel like we're lecturing. I'm like, no, I'm talking to you because I had it in me too. I still have it in me. We know this stuff too. Yeah. It's not just an outside thing. I had to decolonize too.
I did it. Work. Can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're still doing work as well. We have been on this road a little longer. We are a little further down the road. And so you should not be in front of me trying to tell me about anything, white man.
Yeah.
I do not want to hear about purity culture from you. I do not want to hear about patriarchy from you. I do not hear all these things that I don't want to hear about from you. But in order for you to stay in front, you have to keep talking about what you know. And so you don't want to dive in. You don't want to take the 5 years. You don't want to disappear from the spotlight. You don't want to step out of the way.
That's right. You don't want to disappear from the limelight because you could have taken those 5 years and plus 10 of just reading quietly with your ass on a couch. And instead, we got you on a new podcast and an Instagram. And I've only seen one person completely divest themselves and give up platform for, I think it was black and brown folks in their community. One. In this deconstruction world, seen it happen once. Like, I have issues here.
Yeah. And, you know, we need white men in this space to talk to white men.
Get your people. Power. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you can be here and you can be doing your thing as long as you are confronting the bigger fish, right? So there are people, there are a lot of in deconstruction that I don't have a problem with because they're not first of all, if they were a pastor before, they have completely stepped away from that and have acknowledged the harm that they have done, and they are not trying to recreate that pattern in that space here. So either that's happening or they were never a pastor and now they are fighting Christian nationalism, or they like they're taking on the big fish. They're not talking about purity culture. They're not trying to comfort women. Like they're not talking down to people. Like if you are,
well, I mean, so, some
like the ones that I approve
roll
of.
With. Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other.
Listen, we're not saying all white people. Okay, white people.
We need white men to talk to white men.
Yeah, get your people.
Get your people.
Yeah, go get your people. Yeah, so one of the factors of whiteness, however, is that as you go get your people, white folks, by and large, and I will say in church, the vast majority, 99%, I should do a PhD on it to prove it, they are used to listening to white voices as authorities in their space. And so that's how these influencers become such. And white folks don't know how to be discipled by black, brown, and indigenous folks. It's like kind of weird.
They don't know yet.
Okay. Yeah.
And some of them, some of them will never get there.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But when I first deconstructed, when I first came out, again, white supremacy lived still in me as well. And so some of the first voices I was listening to when I came out were white men, right? And I needed like, okay, this is the voice I'm used to hearing thumbs up from, to hear this is okay. So for me, it was good. Okay, this is the voice I recognize, and they're saying stuff that is helping me right now.
Yeah.
But then there's a point where I mature past that. And so now I need a new place. I need somewhere else to go. So there are people on that journey now. And so me being loud and being like, I think this fool is a fool, helps the people who are ready to hear that and ready to put that on.
Yeah.
Say, okay, there's somewhere to go. So I was just going to say, so like, there's a bunch of people, there are a bunch of white people, and like, the algorithm makes me mad and it frustrates me as well. But then at the same time, I'm like, no, that's good, because they're obviously not ready.
We end our conversation chatting a little bit about the Black and Brown, our own experience of deconstructing out of white evangelicalism.
I mean, because we are a product of where we came from.
Yeah,
right?
So there's like a pragmatic reality.
Yeah. Yeah. And we deconstructed from white evangelicalism. And so our path out is very different from, I know people who deconstructed from Black evangelicalism. Right. And they have different sets of reasons. The different things didn't set right with them, and different books and different voices they were listening to coming out. We are, we're part of, the white evangelicalism separation package, right? The severance package. We're part of that.
Anyway, did we get paid too for that? Still waiting.
The way the evangelicalism severance packages work, like we paid.
Still paying. Nice. Who's covering these therapy bills? Right. Oh, me. Right.
Still me. Yeah. So we have those same voices in common, and they're useful for a time, but you get to a point where like, there's nothing we don't know about white men and what they believe or what they think. How they think. Like, the oppressed always know the oppressor better than the oppressor knows them, or the oppressor knows themselves, right? Because there are a lot of things that the oppressor just cannot admit themselves about themselves
and system and individual. Hey, we getting paid for all this expertise? Why does everything have to be paid, Rohatty? See, I got to unlearn my capitalism.
Capitalism, that's in there too. There's nothing a white man can tell me. And it's crazy, right? That those are the voices still being highlighted, still being favored. Yeah, but again, there's a wide market, because there are a lot of people, most people coming out. They need that landing zone. They need that space. I wish more of them would get out of there faster. But
you don't have to. I don't think you have to. I think you can stay there.
Stay there too, but stay away from me. Right? Like, so I've had to be like, no, like, I'm when I'm going up against this bro evangelical, it is not because I want his followers, because I don't. Because if they're not already over here, they're not me. And I don't want to hold you. And
I don't know you. Have
stupid arguments with you either. So stay over there. I'm not talking to you right now. But one day, you're going to hear me or hear someone differently and be like, you know what? Actually, I think I've gotten all I can get from.
Hope so.
Because they're,
it's
a very limited resource.
You can only go so far, and it ain't very far.
Yeah.
Within the belly of the beast.
Thank you, Janice. Her music is throughout this episode, and you can find her latest album on Spotify. Links in the show notes. The purpose behind Farewell Evangelicalism is to bring experts in the field to name these malformed pillars in the hopes that folks will leave this malformed tradition. But it's not just about white evangelicalism. There are malformed pillars in a variety of different church traditions, be it Black church traditions, Chinese, and other ethnic traditions. It's also important to bring on practitioners, folks you may have never heard from before. They don't have big social media profiles, but we want to capture the voice of people on the ground because that's our voice. My next guest is Greg. And Greg, similar to Janice, involved in worship, connected into his own Black church experience, but also trying to figure out what deconstruction looks like in that context. Adjacent to white evangelicalism, sometimes in, but also adjacent to his Black church tradition. I asked him a little bit about the language he uses because he does include deconstruction and decolonizing as terms in his podcast.
Definitely have baggage. They do intersect in different ways. I think the deconstruction is the first step. I think the deconstruction is you just sitting back and wondering. Because a part of my deconstruction was reading James Stone. Mm. Because I had never read or knew anything about James Stone, never heard of womanist theology. All these beautiful theologies formulated by Black people that I had never even heard of. And so learning about those and exploring those for me was the deconstruction piece. Just kind of beginning to question, that's a deconstruction. And so the decolonization comes into play when you begin to kind of undo what white supremacy has taught you. And when you begin to embrace thoughts, whether they be ancestral thoughts, indigenous thoughts, and you begin to realize that all these things are very beautiful and they have their place. And they are not to be demonized based upon what European settlers were teaching people at any given time. Because another part for me of the decolonization is realizing that God is bigger than Christianity.
Ooh,
and okay. That's something that, that's a conversation I've had with my father and other, you know, seminary friends multiple times, just begin to realize that our imaginations are much too small when it comes to God.
Mm-hmm. What was the church tradition you grew up in? Or I'm assuming that you grew up in the church.
Yeah, Dad was a pastor, so you were right to a song. It was the CME Church. So that's a historically Black Christian denomination.
Okay.
And he got his own church when I was 9 years old in a small town in Arkansas. And yeah, and I've served in different spaces, church spaces outside of the CME Church, but that was my foundation growing up under my father and his ministry. Once I became an adult and started working in different spaces, I've served in Presbyterian churches. I've worked in different, like more charismatic spaces as well. So I've kind of run the gamut. I even played piano at a Catholic mass for several months. Yeah, I've had a diverse array of experiences when it comes to church.
I pose that question to Greg because deconstruction is generally referring to a white experience out of white, usually evangelicalism. I've heard other BIPOC folks say they're reticent to use the term, and for good reason, because it doesn't reflect our experience, which is partially true. I asked Greg for his thoughts on whether it's a term worth reclaiming.
That's a good question. I think about the commentary of different theologians that I respect as it relates to deconstruction. And I do think it's steeped in whiteness. Just like a lot of things are, most things in the world are. But I still think that for a person's own personal journey where they are, the terms can serve some value. Just like some people think that Christianity has no place. But I think about my beautiful Black ancestors who use Christianity as a tool of liberation and not a tool of oppression. So I don't ever think that Christianity won't have a place for me personally. And I think the same is true for certain terms like deconstruction, decolonization. I think they serve a purpose for each individual. And so I think it's a very personal thing. I just know that for me, the decolonization is where I kind of land.
Yeah.
At this point, anyway, yeah. Just because I've kind of done all the questionings, like, you know, I've come to my own conclusions about things. And so now it's just a journey, a continuous journey.
Yeah.
And that's what faith is to me anyway. It's a journey. It's not a destination. It's an ongoing journey.
Like, we hear that a lot for other things, you know, it's along the journey. You're on the journey. It's always a journey. But one of the pieces of deconstruction, I feel, especially when it comes out of theological whiteness or even whiteness in general culturally, is that it's trying to land at a finite point. And there's a reach for answers, you know what I mean? Like, we have arrived and answers versus like other folks. And I want to say BIPOC folks, I think there's something to say about folks on the margins, bodies on the margins that have been pushed to the margins that just have a different notion of how to conduct life, in that you are always becoming versus trying to find the answers to arrive.
Yes, I do think that there is I think that's a longing that's very rooted in whiteness, white evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Just this need for objectivity, this need for certainty. We've got to know the answers. We've got to have it right. We've got to have it all figured out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Versus just embracing the mystery of God and letting that be what it is. And just kind of resting in it and not feeling like you have to know everything, because you can't possibly know everything. And no one has all the answers. So it's kind of ludicrous to pretend that you do. But yeah, I think it's just an ongoing thing. I'm most certainly feeling it.
Yeah, I wonder, although I couldn't connect the dots this way, but I wonder in what manner there are folks who have approached a deconstruction journey and have wound up pretty quickly deconverting, just like losing faith altogether. And part of that I see is not being able to hold uncertainty, or you use the word, which is a way better word, not being able to hold mystery with an open hand.
I think it can very quickly become just this reiteration of fundamentalism when you think that deconverting is the only acceptable way to move forward. It's the same thing, just dressed up differently. And so I try to be mindful of not policing people's faith journey and not policing the answers that they come to, whether it leads to deconversion or not. If for me, for Greg, if it leads to deconversion, I applaud you.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it doesn't, I applaud you for continuing to seek and grow in knowledge and stature, as the Bible mentions Jesus did in Luke. Either way, it's like I commend people for leaving a toxic job or sticking through it and you do something else later on in life. Like, I don't ever want to feel like I'm boxed in, or that I'm boxing someone else in to this rigid way of being, existing, or thinking.
Yeah, I mean, if you got to go, you got to go. You know, I'm not going to tell you otherwise, but like connecting the dots of the deconstruction journey for so many is the and that's where they end. They don't go into a decolonial divestment from white supremacy, is that you just retain these pieces of whiteness, such as certainties, such as
not dealing with your hurt, not addressing patriarchy or other foundations, and you get stuck. When you see worldview is so tiny, you had mentioned off of the hop that you have come to a place where you, God is bigger than Christianity. You said that. Mm-hmm. Unpack that.
What I mean by that is whatever your belief of God is, whether you believe God is a being in the sky, whether you believe God is in everything and all around us, whatever your belief of God is, that belief of God, knowing who God is not exclusive to any one religion or any particular spiritual identity. Mm. Because, you know, I was always taught that God couldn't be boxed in, but yet and still, here we are trying to box God in all the time. Mm-hmm. So God is beyond notions of gender. All the things that humans would try to craft to contain God, God is beyond
our traditions,
God
our theologies, our doctrines.
Absolutely. Because, you know, it's interesting because I was just on, I listen to the Bible for Normal People. I love their podcast. I follow their Instagram page, and I'm always amazed at the people who engage in the comment section who push back on what the videos are saying. And I'm not, you know, you and I both know that Bible scholars disagree often, but this is something that these people have studied and are experts in versus someone.
Yeah.
The average person is just, you go to church every week and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you have no formal training to be sitting here telling a theologian or a Bible scholar that they're wrong.
Yeah, sure.
About something. Yeah. It just, it amazes me. And so I never wanted to, because I'm a very intelligent person, I'm a very smart person, I never wanted to find myself, after a certain point in my journey, I didn't want to find myself in a place of embracing intellectual dishonesty in the name of maintaining a faith that really wasn't even serving me. Not the, like I said earlier, the tools I had been given were no longer serving me in my faith walk. So why should I continue to embrace this cognitive dissonance and this confusion to hold this up? I shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I should explore and be willing to unlearn and learn again things that are more liberating, things that are more true. I should be willing to do that as a person of faith and also as a person who is intelligent and with the brain.
Have you always had that posture?
No.
You see, the church didn't
build
you up, didn't form you in that posture?
Absolutely not. The church indoctrinated me. And this is what it does. But I definitely did not. I was not embracing mystery growing up. It was, and again, I didn't know a lot. I didn't. But I think that I was always experiencing these inklings of what it would look like to be free in people who were around me. Because we were created to be free as people. We were not created to be put in boxes, to be dumbed down or minimized and strumped. We were created to be free to exist fully as we are.
You'll notice that we're starting to talk a little bit more about deconstruction, or the process of making sense of your faith and working out of it, and hopefully trying to hang on to components that give life. That's not all of them. You eventually have to discard pieces. But through the lens of black and brown thinkers and theologians and pastors, there are different ways to reimagine your faith. The final interview is with Christian Nace Smith. This is one of the rare times in this podcast where two pastors go at it. Not a lot of the guests are pastors. Most are authors and writers. But I can only think of Trey Ferguson and now Christian Nace Smith. Pastors just shooting the breeze about deconstruction and decolonizing. Pathways forward that give us more life than what we're used to seeing in church.
Christian A. Smith. I'm a digital pastor and public theologian.
And so you use the term deconstruction a lot as you describe some of the pieces of processing your faith and also inviting others to process what they have been shaped and formed in and then what they could kick out into that's more life-giving, perhaps. But deconstruction, I think, is, especially on the internet, the interwebs, deconstruction is a white-dominated term. I feel like ex-evangelical is adjacent to deconstruction.
Yeah.
Do you feel, so I know you use it in your work for distinct reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that as a kind of reclamation, or is it just describing a very real component of deconstructing your faith formation, which is rooted in Black church tradition?
You know, it's interesting. My use of the term deconstruction really has nothing to do with spirituality or faith. It has everything to do with the fact that I'm a marketer.
Okay.
Right. So
you threw me for a loop there. Let's go. Let's go.
Yeah. So when you don't have language for who you are, it's very difficult to tell people, this is who I am, this is what I do. And to this day, it's difficult for me to do that. So as we were finding our footing as a ministry, the people that I'm called to serve don't gather anywhere together. Like, yeah, they're scattered, yeah, everywhere. Yeah, so yeah, I had to find a term that would be like that dog whistle. Of like,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So if I use the term deconstruction, that'll at least raise people's antenna to, yeah, see, okay, what is this all about? Because deconstruction was the only term that I could see that was being used by people in this, ooh, space.
Mm-hmm.
So I just latched onto it because I also noticed that most of the people using the term deconstruction were white. And, mm-hmm, white spirituality and Black spirituality are two totally different experiences.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. So I noticed that in a lot of the predominantly white deconstruction spaces, it was much more of an intellectual project. But Black people don't engage their faith intellectually, that we primarily engage our faith emotionally. So there's an emotional connection that Black people have to our faith.
Yeah,
and yeah, I wanted to tap into that unique Black experience because there were a lot of Black people and still a lot of Black people who are scattered, because I'm not well known like that. But a lot of Black people who are scattered in these spaces where they don't really have a home. So I wanted to create a space that centers the experience of Black people who are deconstructing, because that's a vastly different experience. We have a session that we do at the faith community called Day One, where it's like an introduction to disruption. So we go through kind of like the framework of the ministry, what grounds the work that we do. And in this session, people share their experiences. And there was one session in particular where there were probably about 12 to 15 people there. And one of them was a white young lady who was listening to these different Black people in the room share their experiences of church and faith and spirituality. And we all talked about a feeling of connection that we had, how we felt the spirit in our bodies. Like, and it's something that you can't fully explain. You just know it when you feel it. You know, that's just like a shared experience that, okay, most, yeah, Black church folk have.
Mm-hmm.
And she said in the meeting, she said, it's so interesting listening to you all talk about your faith experiences, because I can't relate at all. I've never felt what you all feel. And it's just highlighting for me how much of my faith is in my head. So with Black people, when we unlearn a lot of the intellectual stuff, there's still the emotional pull. Because, like, yeah, that doctrine is terrible. But what I felt in that building, what I feel when I am among the rest of the saints, that's real. And I want to hold on to that. Even as I let go of this harmful theology, there's a connection to spirit that is grounded in us from before the transatlantic slave trade, because we had centuries of spirituality before we were kidnapped and had Christianity imposed on us. And you don't lose that over time. So I tell people all the time, growing up in a Black church, my spirituality was African, but my theology was white evangelical.
Ooh, okay.
So it's like, how do I rid myself of this white fundamentalist evangelical theology and hold on to the spirituality that has formed me? And that's where a lot of Black people are in deconstruction. Now, granted, there are a lot of Black people who also say, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And I totally respect that. And some people need to go that route. But for the people who still want to have some type of connection to the the community of faith and that spirituality, then we're a landing place for a lot of those people.
So what does the deconstruction component look like? Or maybe the question is, what are you deconstructing out of formation-wise from your Black church tradition?
It, you know, it's hard to separate how much of it is a residue of European colonialism and how much of
embedded.
Yeah. And how much of it did we, how much of this toxicity did we have before European colonialism? Because one of the things about European colonialism is it strips you of your heritage. So I don't know exactly what faith tradition my ancestors come from. I don't know exactly, did my ancestors come from a matriarchal culture or was it patriarchal, you know? So did my ancestors come from a culture that was affirming of, you know, what we would call LGBTQ plus people? Because all of this has existed in Africa for generations and generations. And European colonialism put a stop to a lot of that. So it's difficult to parse out how much of it we already had and how much of it is strictly European colonialism. It's like we have embraced the homophobia of European colonialism, and it's like ours. We like taking it and owned it to the extent that we're more homophobic than a lot of white spaces. Because you get a lot of Black church kids who identify as queer who have to leave the Black church because they're too queer for the Black church. And then they'll go find a progressive white church and be accepted in their queer identity until there's a Black issue and they find out they're too Black for the white church.
Now, there are other malformed pillars that are worth mentioning in church traditions. I asked Christian about them.
One thing that we really unpack that I am sure transcends European colonialism, and that's the patriarchy. So the women's equity piece is really important. And in a lot of Black church spaces, it's so heavily patriarchal. And it takes a lot of work to undo that. And then another thing that I know, okay, here's a really big one in the Black church tradition that I spend a lot of time unpacking: our perspective on forgiveness. Because, you know, Black people in America who are descendants of slaves were given a theology intended to pacify us. And the forgiveness that we were taught was forced. So it doesn't matter what anybody does to you, you got to forgive them. And they boil it down to a statement of forgiveness rather than a process of forgiveness. So it's like, you got to make the statement and it's done when you make the statement. But really, forgiveness is way more than that. And we were taught forgiveness in a way that benefits the perpetrator and not the victim. And we continue to perpetuate that over time. So that's like one really big thing that I see specifically in the Black church, because our forgiveness as Black people in America has been a hot commodity for generations. It's exploited at every turn.
It's been commodified.
Yes. Yeah, we're supposed to forgive everybody for everything. So Dylann Roof walks into Mother Emanuel and slaughters those people, and the next week they in the courtroom saying, "We forgive you."
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the way that media just ate that up.
Absolutely. They jumped all over it. Oh, the Black church members forgave Dylann Roof.
So important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is what it's all about. No, it's not. That's how we stay in these damn cycles of oppression. Because we're forgiving people that are actively harming us. And that you can't do that. You can't forgive somebody while they're actively harming you.
Yeah.
So that's one of those things that we have to unlearn as Black church folk. We did not choose Christianity. It was forced upon us, and we got a distorted version of Christianity. So like when there are a lot of people who have completely discarded Christianity, and I don't even call myself a Christian. I'm a spiritual humanist. Like, for people who need labels, I identify as a spiritual humanist, and I follow the way of Jesus. Like, my theological framework is birthed out of, or is a byproduct of, my lived experiences and my encounter with the story of Jesus, which is a lot different from fundamentalist Christian theology.
Yeah.
So, you know, how else could we have you and I sitting here talking about the ministry or the way of Jesus as two progressive, you know, freedom-oriented people? And then on the flip side, the January 6th insurrectionists did it in the name of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So like we're not even talking about the same Jesus.
Yeah. You were sharing about reclamation of identity, and what do you do when you do not know your people, your ancestors, your traditions? And so what that does is it makes the process of decolonizing one's faith different, maybe even more difficult, that you don't know your ancestors, what type of culture, how did they not merely live, but you named, did they organize in a patriarchal fashion? Was it the matriarchs who were in charge? So in practice today, when you think of, and maybe first like name whether you use terms like decolonizing, but when it comes to finding decolonial ways of moving forward in faith, when you don't have those pieces of your ancestors, who and what do you appeal to as your source for new foundations? And yes, you know, Jesus is the answer to all these things, but we're looking for some more pieces.
Yeah, lived experience is where I hang my hat. One rule that we have in our community of faith is that we honor each other's lived experiences, and we don't uplift theory or doctrine above what people have actually lived. So in our community, if your theory or your doctrine contradicts someone's lived experience, then we challenge you to take that as an opportunity to learn from what they have lived. Because for too long, our doctrines and theologies have been promoted at the expense of our lived experiences, at the neglect of our lived experiences. So I really, really ground a whole lot of my theology in lived experience. Going back ancestrally, I guess, if that's a word, I'll start with my immediate ancestors. You know, my parents, my grandparents, my dad is an ancestor. Yeah, those that I know.
Yeah.
And then I know more. Well, I am almost sure that my ancestry goes back to West Africa. So I look at some of the spiritual practices in those areas, right? So like Yoruba spirituality or, you know, Igbo, there are these different cultures within West Africa. I don't know which one I come from, but I'm going to tell you what really, really helped me in this age of social media is being able to see Africans in real time and how they worship, how they praise, how they commune, how they gather, and how similar that is to us here. It's like, oh yeah, we related, right? Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. I can watch Africans worship in the bush. I'm talking about like still tribal Africans, and their worship experiences look just like ours. So it's like, oh, we probably were in the same tribe or like neighboring tribes or something like that, because that's a cultural experience.
You're singing the same song.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And do you mean worship as generally worship, not a Christian form of worship?
Right, yeah, not Christian. I'm talking about like in the bush. I'm talking about tribal Africans, like the way they dance in their ceremonies and rituals.
Yes.
There's something called a ring shout, right? So growing up in the Black church, when somebody would like catch the spirit and start dancing and shouting and all of that stuff, in some churches the ushers would come together and you get like two or three ushers and they would hold hands and create a ring around the person to kind of, when I was growing up, I thought it was like just to keep them contained, not understanding the ring shout goes all the way back to our African heritage. Mm-hmm. So I see these connections between all of that. And then also understanding the importance of women and matriarchs in African spirituality, like the root workers, and you know, and we now in our context in America, the practice of hoodoo is like this combination of ancestral West African practices and Christianity. So we like incorporated that when we got here, but unfortunately, white supremacy is so effective that it has the Black church demonizing African spirituality when the Black church wouldn't be the Black church without African spirituality.
Dang. Shucks, man. That's so good. That's cool. I loved hearing what you were sharing as both you reclaim back to your people and you saw these features that were similar, but also of someone displaced and disconnected from ancestry. In many ways, that's me as well. Mm-hmm. What do you do in the present, in the right here, right now? And to elevate the stories and experiences of the bodies and of the people in the moment right here, right now, as a tool and expression of decolonial living. Mm-hmm. That's like, oh yeah, there's so many similarities to our own ministry and just how we live.
Decolonizing is just as important for non-Black people too. Like the faith community, that's our, you know, our digital ministry. So we center the experiences of Black people, but white people are definitely welcome. They just have to be comfortable with the reality that they're not going to be centered in this space, which a lot of white people struggle with because they're accustomed to being centered everywhere they go. So we don't have a lot of white people, but we do have some. And one of them shared how our recurring series called Black Women in African Spirituality really inspired them to look into their ancestral heritage beyond whiteness. Yeah. So she decided, let me look into where I come from spiritually. Yeah. And she traced her heritage back to Celtic Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And she said she immediately felt a connection with how Celtic Christianity worships. It she felt it in her bones. Like there's an ancestral connection that all of us have. But white people got to get past the whiteness to get to the actual culture.
You have to get past the bland in order to find who you are.
Absolutely.
And your people.
Because the culture of whiteness is violence. You know, people say white folk don't have a culture. The culture of whiteness is violence.
Whiteness, and it always wins.
Yes, it was constructed in the name of violence. That's why whiteness was constructed. So it's going to be difficult to connect to your ancestral practices if you're connecting everything to the fact that you're white. There is no rich heritage of white spirituality. But if you go back and look at your Irish spirituality your Italian or Swedish, like you might find something of value there.
Thank you very much for listening to episode number 8 in Farewell Evangelicalism. I'm Ro Hattie. Thank you, Janice. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Christian. I hope you were able to capture some aspects, some previews of the possibilities of how your faith can gain life, especially if it's been bringing harm or it's been detracting from you living out your whole self. We're going to keep on rolling. Next episode is coming, episode 9. Let's talk about grief. Let's talk about loss, because as you start noticing the cracks in your faith formation, it hurts to let it go. All this and more coming at you, Faith in the Fresh 5. Let's hold the world together. Please help me hold the world together. I know we can hold the world together. Let's hold the world. Tell me again how lucky I am to live on the bright side of the wings of a bad inventor, never making amends. I'll always know now, the end was always in how it all began. And if all ends well in love, why am I the only one still dying for an answer? Some other way to hold off this disaster. Let's hold the world. To get back to my body. Give me time to get back to my body. Give me time to get back to my body. Let's hold the world together. Let's hold the world.